Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
I'm Sheila Shoiga, and welcome to Ready to Be Real Conversations, the podcast series where I chat to people of all walks of life. Some names you'll recognise, others you might not, but my hope is that these conversations will at times inspire, challenge, educate, comfort, or simply entertain you. This week, I speak to champion freediver Claire Walsh.
I have done some really cool things. I have gone to cool places, I've tried cool activities, and all of them will have come from one little place of sitting, maybe in my PJs, with loads of coffee cups around me, or cups of tea, and empty packs of crisps, and who knows what's happened. All of them will have come from a really low moment.
Yeah.
So something really great can come from sitting in the shit.
Originally from Leixlip, she currently lives in Bray with her partner Booty, and she's been free diving for 6 years now. She's competitive and driven, but there's also a beautiful gentleness about her that allows her to connect to her breath and to the water and achieve what she has already, which is incredible. She can hold her breath underwater for an impressive 5 minutes 59 seconds, and she can dive to 59 metres on one breath alone. A fan of therapy and regular self-care habits like sea swimming, mindfulness and meditation, this is a fascinating listen, as she covers so much, from her love and respect of the water from an early age to struggling with her mental health in her 20s. And she also talks about her other passions in life, music, drama and performance. And I started the conversation by asking her about contracting COVID-19 back in January.
So I actually went training in Egypt from October, November, December. I came home for Christmas and was due to go back out mid-January. Mm. I was going to start an amazing training cycle. It was going to be the makings of me. And January 2nd, I developed symptoms of COVID. I was a close contact as well, so it wasn't a massive shock.
Okay.
And kind of January is a little bit of a blur. Yeah, it is. It's a little bit of a blur. Kind of, I think about 4 or 5 days in, I can't quite remember. I know it was a Tuesday. My breathing started to accelerate. It felt different.
Okay.
And I do spend a lot of time cultivating an awareness of my breath. And it was off. I knew it was off. So I rang my GP and he said, go straight to A&E. And that just seemed like a wild overreaction. I didn't want to be one of those numbers. And suddenly things got very, very real. So I said, look, I'll wait it out and I'll see how I feel in a few hours. So I actually rang him back that evening and he asked me to count the amount of breaths per minute. And it was way too high.
Okay.
So I was encouraged again to go to A&E and my partner doesn't drive. So he said, call an ambulance. And that just that felt scary.
Yeah.
I said, no, I'm grand. And within an hour, I just thought, nope, I'm not grand. So we did call an ambulance. And actually, the paramedics were terrific. They checked me out in the ambulance. They then brought me into Vincent's. I spent the night in there and they did more tests and things like that. I got sent home the next morning and that's when things got real. I think, you know, I was joking with Dan, I think his name was Dan, the paramedic man, all the way through. And he was saying, gosh, you don't sound like, you know, you're that out of breath. And I said, no, really, this is out of breath for me. And it wasn't until the next morning, kind of whatever, I got back into bed at 6 or 7 o'clock and just had that feeling of, oh my God, that was a lot. You know, that was a lot. I think at the time I was trying to keep it light for myself.
Yeah.
I was on my own in the room. But yeah, that was a little bit of a scare and a real reality check in that moment.
Yeah.
So, you know, I thought, you know, our isolation period passed and thought, okay, it'll eventually fade out. And, you know, I started making plans and looking up, you know, what gyms I'd rejoin once everything reopened. Like, I laugh at it now, the absolute naivety of it.
Okay.
And I think maybe towards the end of February, I put up on Instagram that I had COVID, and a few people contacted me and said, look, be careful of long COVID, here are the symptoms and so on. And I very much had the opinion, oh, that wouldn't be me. You know, probably that was for other people.
Yeah.
Because a few members of my family had COVID as well, and they were fine. In fact, some of them were also asymptomatic during their, despite having the positive test results. So I think I was in an element of denial. And it wasn't until I was on a Zoom call with a couple of pals who have a lovely accountability group. We work for ourselves. We have a lovely accountability group. So I was on a Zoom call and I said, just one sec, I'm going to pop over and close the window. And I walked, you know, a couple of steps, came back, sat down. I was out of breath for 5-10 minutes. Like, I actually had to turn off my camera, turn off my mic. I was out of breath, like I had just sprinted.
Okay.
And that must be,
yeah, exactly. That's scary, for, yeah, especially for someone like you,
yeah,
who's, you know, your life revolves around breath work.
Yeah.
And tuning into your breath and having control of your breath.
Yeah. And, you know, it was scary, but it was also, it was really sad.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I free dive, I hold my breath, and there's a lot of, I've developed a lot of inherent trust with my lungs.
Yeah.
And I felt like we had a bit of a fight. You know, they had let me down, and which is, it's the wrong way to think about it, but it would just, on one side, I felt incredibly lucky. I was thinking, oh my gosh, if I was vulnerable, if I had asthma or whatever, that I was somehow compromised, how would that have felt? It was terrifying being fit and having an awareness and knowing how to try and slow things down. So how would it have felt if I had been compromised? And that gave me a whole new respect for what a huge part of our population had gone through over the previous year, whatever, 10, 11 months. And then the other side, the probably a little more ego-driven side, was just like, come on, no, this isn't how we do things. So there was, look, we've made up since, myself and my breath. We yeah, sat down, we hashed things out. But there was a sense of mistrust. Just, it was really strange. It's like being in someone else's body. That's probably the best way to describe it.
Yeah. Well, it's obvious that it has impacted you physically, mentally, and emotionally. You can feel it from you.
Yeah.
Long COVID is not something I've discussed so far in the podcast. Can you kind of? I know that tiredness is a huge factor. Mm-hmm. Breath is obviously another one. But the main symptoms that people can have as a result of having COVID-19.
So really early on, well, for early for me, so that's about kind of March, February, March of this year, someone sent me on the list of symptoms. Oh my gosh, there is so many.
Yeah.
It's such a huge, huge list. For me, I experience fatigue is probably my main one. And that's probably the most debilitating one. So fatigue, breathlessness, which has improved, I'm happy to say. Some people don't get their sense of smell back. Some people don't get their sense of taste back.
Yeah.
And there is, you know, anosmia clinics. So anosmia, not being able to smell. There are clinics to help develop that. I can't imagine what that must be like. Muscle aches, joint aches, people have experienced dizziness, nausea, back pain, pains in the ribs.
It's extensive. Yeah. So for you, really, it's fatigue and I suppose shortness of breath are the two biggies.
Yeah.
But at least, do you feel like you said you're gaining kind of, I suppose you're expanding the breath again.
Yeah, the breath. And I think, so there is kind of now some thinking that people who have long COVID, it's about being stuck in fight or flight. So in the, I always mix up these two, sympathetic nervous system. So your body is locked into that this state of stress or tension. And I think a lot of us, long COVID or not, having emerged from, I don't know how many lockdowns we've done at this stage, or even such a bizarre year and a half, they are also in that state. So constantly fight or flight, not in a state of high stress, but there's that kind of steady hum underlying everything.
Yeah.
So there has been some talk that, you know, breath work obviously helps trigger the PNS, parasympathetic nervous system, which is really tricky to say quickly.
Yeah.
PNS is easiest. to trigger PNS. So that's why breath work is so important. I did speak to a sports physician maybe 2 months ago at this stage, and he was so excited about the work I'd done around holding my breath and developing that skill, because so much of that is about developing flexibility in your rib cage, the mental aspect of it as well. And then the big part of it is being able to slip quite easily into the parasympathetic nervous system.
Yeah.
So I'm slowly coming back to doing a little bit of breath work to hopefully take myself out of that fight or flight. And that's something I would have been aware of before, but now I'm really conscious of the physical effects of being locked into that mode.
And it must be very humbling for somebody like you who, you know, you can hold your breath for almost 6 minutes underwater, which is phenomenal, to then kind of go back. It's like baby steps again.
Yeah.
You have to kind of go back to the start.
Absolutely. And that's a huge part of the mental side of things. I did a breath hold table.
Yeah.
The start of last week. So it's you breathe and prepare for 2 minutes. You hold your breath for 2 minutes. You breathe and prepare for 1 minute 45, and you hold your breath for two. And so the time preparing goes down and the breath hold stays the same. That's one way of doing it. And I really, I parked my ego, or so I thought.
Okay.
And really brought the amount of time holding my breath down to a minimum, kind of thinking, this is a baseline. You know, I'll definitely be able to hit that. It was such a struggle. Mm. It was. That's the word. It was so humbling.
Mm.
And kind of, you know, I'm sure we'll chat about it in to a greater extent, but the reason why I love holding my breath, even on dry land, is because it gives you a really good chance to assess how you are emotionally and mentally.
Yes.
So, you know, when I'm lying there holding my breath and trying to ease into the sensations, trying to let go of tension, trying to use my energy efficiently, and that includes thought.
Mm.
So there is a huge softness around it. All I could feel is tension. And then those racing thoughts, and then the thoughts that come in to hijack and go, maybe not today. Oh, maybe today's not a good day. You don't want to injure yourself. You know, all these kind of excuses your brain is flinging at you to go abort, abort, abort. And, you know, I did think I'd gotten to a point in diving or breath hold where, you know, that's much easier to redirect. Not last Monday.
Yeah.
But look, this is part of... I try and say the word journey too much.
You obviously are on one.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's this is an easy statement to embrace when things are going well, but I find it very hard when things are not. But I suppose it depends on where you stand on the, do things happen for a reason or not?
Yeah.
But when something like this happens, you're kind of going, really?
Yeah.
Did I really need this?
Yeah.
You know, especially with what I do for a living, what my passion is, you're going to give me feckin' long COVID to deal with. Are you for real?
COVID was bad enough.
Yeah.
But the long COVID, no thank you very much.
No thanks. I have to get on with stuff.
Exactly. Things to do.
But it'll be interesting to see what the next 6 months will hold for you in terms of your recovery and where perhaps there's a redirection happening in your life. But maybe that's a conversation for another day. Yeah. I know we have so much to get into. I didn't expect us to begin with COVID, but thank you for sharing so openly. I'd love to go back to you as a kid and, you know, I suppose jumping into the sea and swimming with your family and your love of it.
Yeah. So I have two sisters and one brother, and I'm the eldest. And swimming was a big part of her life. Every Saturday evening, Dad took us swimming. It was just the thing we did. And I think it started myself, my sister, and then the other sister came along, and then my brother at the end. So swimming consisted of lessons, and I was doing lengths, my sister doing lengths, Sarah, my other sister doing lengths, and then Matt was doing widths, and then he'd move up to lengths as well. And then those competitions were all desperately competitive. Training, inverted commas, finished with competition. Yeah. So Dad would give me a 5 second head start, Katie a 6 second head start, and so on. And like that's my resounding memory, and it's such a happy one, such a competitive one.
And where does that competitiveness come from? Your dad?
Oh, we're all desperate. Oh, Dad.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, we're all desperate. Look, as we say, if you're not, you know, losing, if you're still speaking to each other after Monopoly, you're not playing hard enough. That's Christmas, not the games.
Yeah.
But races were a big part. And then Dad used to get like weighted rings and throw them in the deep end, and we'd scramble to get them. That essentially is free diving.
So
I was doing that for years, and then playtime was a big thing. And like playtime would be, God only knows what we did. I remember bringing a snorkel and mask into the pool. God knows what I looked like. And like lying on the bottom of the pool, there are my memories. And then the odd time Mum would be dragged to watch us. So that's when you bring out the handstands. That's when you bring out all your tricks. And Mum would be chatting to the other women like, Mum, look at me. So, it's a really, really happy memory. And we would have gone holidays, you know, in Ireland and then a little bit later on in France or wherever. Mm. So going into the water was a really big part of it. Mum doesn't swim.
Yeah.
You know, as Mum says, she doesn't even like to get her face wet in the shower.
Yeah.
So she really doesn't swim.
Yeah.
But all of us have learned, have really enjoyed it. And I think we all have a really healthy respect for the water. And I think that's
so important.
Yeah. And I know I've spoken to my sister about this, but we've all gone off traveling at different stages, and our respect of the water, our comfort in the water and our ability allow us to try things like scuba diving or snorkeling or, you know, whatever activity that so many of these trips, you know, revolve around.
Even though it's an impossibility to predict what's going to happen, I think when you have an understanding and a respect for the sea, you're going to listen to your instinct more. You're going to be a bit more aware while taking risks and doing cool things. You're still going to know, well, there's a line here, maybe I don't cross it. Or
absolutely,
that understanding keeps you safe.
Yes, and you know, the water is the variable. It's changeable. The minute you think you're totally safe and you completely have it is when things get turned on its head. So
that's so important.
A humble approach to water, I find, is always a probably good way to go at it.
Yeah. And then, I mean, I know I'm jumping forward now, but in terms of when you are underwater and you're holding your breath for 5 minutes, 59 seconds, which blows my mind, there's nowhere to hide. As in, like, you know, when we're doing breath work on land, and I would have had this in the beginning when I really started to embrace my yoga training, and we'd be, you know, doing it, breathing exercises. And then it's like, you know, put your hand up when you kind of have to take that inhale or whatever.
Yeah.
And maybe the hand should have went up earlier, because I'd be kind of telling myself, no, I didn't take a breath, but I probably...
Little sneaky
bits of air seeping in gently, but I wasn't a proper one, so I don't need to put my hand
up. Never counts.
But you can't lie underwater.
No, and that is my quote. You cannot lie underwater. You can't lie to yourself.
Yeah.
You can't lie to others about how you are. It all comes out underwater. This idea of fake it till you make it.
Mm.
You know, and that's something that I think a lot of people live by. Plaster a smile onto your face and go, yeah, no problem, and nod and figure out how to do it later on. And with free diving or holding your breath or being in water, it has to be the other way around. It has to be building from the inside out.
But isn't that brilliant?
It is.
That is being truly authentic.
It's such a different way to do things. And I learned that the hard way with a couple of dives. But going back to... Them not going well.
Okay.
But going back to this idea of there's nowhere to hide.
Mm.
I think about it, you know, even to a greater extent, how often do you sit in your thoughts, in your body without music on, without your phone, without. When you're in water, you can't do that. So even that discomfort, I think, is... I always underestimate it, and I'm always horrified by how great that discomfort is of just being.
And is it, when you're under the water, are you looking for a distraction?
So when...
How different is it as an experience?
It's really different. So doing it dry, it's really uncomfortable. It's really, really uncomfortable because you don't have the sensation of the water. So then
interesting. So
yeah.
it's more uncomfortable... On dry
I
land.
I find it more uncomfortable
even
dry.
Though you could kind of cheat.
No, but that cheating's not worth it.
I know. Why am I talking about cheating all the time? Sorry, I'm revealing way too much about myself. What I mean is, you know, I feel like, and this is probably my showing my own naivety on the topic, is that you're safe on land.
But you don't get any of the benefits that make it easier. There's so many dangling carrots by just being in the water. There's so many. So this thing of holding your breath on dry land is just so boring to me. It's not boring. It's challenging. It's crap and it's not lovely. Whereas there's a whole other dimension that can't be replicated dry. It's not the same. So for example, a dry exercise would look like me on my back in my sitting room or bedroom, whatever. I'm wearing a nose clip, so I am breathing through my mouth. So you do your prep time and then your hold time, prep time, hold time, and so on. So that feeling of taking that big breath where you're so full of air, it's quite uncomfortable.
Mm.
And that's why stretching and lung stretches and flexibility in your thorax is so important. But when I'm in the water, I'm face down. So that pressure comes against my chest. So it doesn't feel as intense. That expansion has a little bit of a pushback. If that makes sense.
Mm.
And also, I do it wearing a nose clip, but my eyes are exposed to water. So there's a really cool feeling against my eyes. I can hear water, you know, the sound of above is dulled. So I won't say it's womb-like, but there is, and you're supported, you know, all your limbs are supported. So it's much easier to get into a state of relaxation for me anyway.
I can't help but thinking as well about one of my favourite films that I saw in my 20s, The Big Blue.
The Grand Blue, it's incredible.
I remember watching it and going, oh, this is the most amazing. I don't know how many times I've seen it since, but it just blew me away. So if anybody hasn't seen it, it's Luc Besson. It was made in the late 80s.
The
stunning.
The actors in it came to the World Championships in 2019.
The year you were there.
Yeah.
No
incredible.
Way. Jean Reno and the other hot dude. I never remember his name.
The other hot dude, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's what we just called him.
Did you meet him?
I met him from a distance.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah. But it's incredible.
Oh, it's a brilliant film.
It is incredible.
It's amazing.
Yeah. No, it's a must for any water lover or free diver.
Yeah. So listening to you, I'm thinking of the scenes in the movie where it is otherworldly when you're in the water and you're doing your thing. What do you think of? What comes to mind, or does anything come to mind?
Oh, my gosh. Everything comes to mind. Mm. Everything comes to mind. And again, it is that element of whatever's going on for you at the time will be amplified or exposed.
Yeah,
so if you think of, I don't know, the example in my head is in 2016, I had learned how to free dive. I wanted to go back out to the place where I'd learned and spend 6 to 7 weeks learning more and free diving. So in preparation, I was at the gym, and physically I was really, really fit, but my lifestyle was chaotic. Absolutely chaotic. Was also my sister was getting married shortly afterwards, so there was lots of things going on there, and it was just crazy. There was no mindfulness. There was lots of fake it till you make it, lots of figuring things out on the go and move. So when I got out there and started diving and kind of was expecting to hit PBs, personal bests, you know, within a really short space of time, and I was diving shallower than I'd ever dived before, And I got really frustrated, and then I got an ear infection, and then. So I came out of the water for a week, and I had to slow things down.
Mm.
I had to come out of the water because I had an ear infection. So while I was doing that, I'll try a little bit of meditation, begrudgingly. Mm. You know, maybe I'll do a mindful practice. You know, I said in the most sulky voice ever.
Yeah.
But the reality is I had completely neglected that side of the sport. And without that side, the water doesn't care how strong you are. It doesn't care how much you can lift in the gym or how strong your legs are for kicking down. Unless you are mentally, emotionally comfortable, softened is always the word I go to.
Yes.
Your mind won't let you get down there without getting injured.
But isn't that so true for anything in life? It is, it is about a balance of all of those things.
Yeah.
Because so often you can have somebody who says, it's a stereotype, but the gym bunny.
Yeah.
Who is completely allergic to talking about emotions or thinking about what's going on for them. But, there's an imbalance there. While they may look physically a certain way.
Yeah.
And the same goes for the other extreme. The person who doesn't ever want to put the runners on and do any exercise or do anything like that, but is very comfortable talking about feelings and everything, but they're neglecting the physical side. So we really do have to find some sort of balance for ourselves as individuals.
Completely.
Regardless of what we do.
And this sport, for me, has everything.
Yeah.
It does appeal to, I think, well, probably it hooked in the competitive side first.
Yeah.
But honestly,
and you were good at it. Like early on, you realised this is something I can do.
Yeah, I think so. Like a lot of beginners have a really steep progress curve, if that's the way to put it. They progress very quickly. And I think that was the case for me. And then there's a plateau, and then, you build a new set of skills and you continue on. And the whole thing with freediving, if you advance too quickly before your physiology had a chance to adapt, you can do quite an injury.
Yeah.
So there is always that kind that
and
awareness.
Scary injuries.
Yeah, scary injuries, 100%.
It is a risky sport.
It is. It's not as dangerous as people perceive, and I am saying that, putting little asterisks beside it as I mentally. Obviously, it's a dangerous sport. We're holding our breath underwater, but it's not as dangerous as the perception, because there are inbuilt rules. So the primary rule is never dive alone.
Yeah.
And I don't know how many people I've heard saying, but I'm only going to do... I don't care. You do not hold your breath underwater on your own. From having seen that little bit more, things can change in an instant. And again, like I said at the start, the sea is the variable. Water isn't constant.
Yeah.
So you can never account for what changes might happen there. So you are never in full control. So you dive with a buddy and you develop quite a lot of trust with that buddy, and they know how far you can push and how far you can't push. And for me anyway, when I'm diving with my buddy and we have a good relationship, I don't want to do something that will put them in danger.
Yeah.
Because that's where they'll have to deal with it. Not me. I'll be unconscious. So I'm not going to do that to anyone.
Yeah.
So that's why, partnering with the right person is really, really important.
For somebody listening who is hearing you speak about freediving but doesn't quite fully get what it entails, we know already that it involves holding your breath underwater. Mm-hmm. But is there a fuller description
of
what it is?
So, freediving, it's a sport of holding your breath underwater, and it's been around for years and years and years. It's used by the fishermen to get pearls, and Greece and Japan have a huge history of it.
Yeah.
It is a relatively new sport. I think it's around the 90s. It became a competitive sport. But there's a few different disciplines. So your static breath hold is lying flat on the surface of the water, face down, so airways submerged. So your static breath hold, lying still, lying static, will be your longest breath hold, because you're conserving energy by not moving.
Yeah, yeah.
So my static is 5:59.
Incredible.
That's six. Oh, it gets me every time. So static is your longest breath hold. And then there are pool disciplines and they're measured in distance. So think of when you're a kid, or I don't know if you did this, we did this, swimming underneath the water up and down, and how far you can go. Mm. It's obviously quite an elevated version of that, but that's essentially what it is. So it's under the water, laps of a pool. And then there's the depth disciplines. So,
and you do this as well.
And this is my favorite.
This is the big blue territory.
This is big blue. and that's why everyone loves depth.
Yeah.
So surface of the water, there'll be a platform or a buoy or buoy. Here in Europe, we say buoy. If I say buoy out there, they don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
They don't know who I'm referring to. So I always mix buoy and buoy. So there'll be a buoy or buoy. And then dropped from that, there's a rope. And at the bottom of that rope, there's a pile of weights. And you decide how far you want those weights to be down. So today I'm going to do a 60 meter dive. So the weights will be dropped down 60 meters and there's markings on the ropes to know how far to let it down. And I'm wearing a carabiner and a lanyard, and I'll hook that carabiner on. I prepare at the surface, and my preference, the way I like to prepare, is face down. I'll wear a snorkel, and that's when I go into my lovely meditation. See how I say meditation different now? It's not in the sulky voice. So I'll start my meditations. I'll start my breathe up, which is the type of breathing you do to prepare. So the idea is to go fully into parasympathetic. There we go, PNS.
Yeah.
Lower the heart rate, clear the head, clear the mind, soften all those voices who say, maybe not today, you know.
Yeah, silence the inner critic.
Yeah, and I just imagine just like a bubble coming around me. And I play this little game, and this isn't a general free diving practice. This is just me. I try to listen to what the sea is telling me. I try and talk to, I try and talk to the depth. And
I love
kind
this.
Of, I ask for an invitation.
Yeah, okay.
You know, what's happening today? This is where I want to go. How are you feeling? You know, it's trying to just build a dialogue.
And connection. You're so 100%. Deeply connected with the sea, with nature.
Yeah, and, you know, and I dive in the Blue Hole quite a lot. So the Blue Hole's in Egypt and Dahab. And it is a 93-meter drop-off, just a couple of meters from the shore. So you have 93 meters of depth, and it's surrounded by coral.
Wow.
And the light there is incredible. So the flickers of light, you can see 30 meters down, to me are always just indicating what the mood is like today, or whether there'll be a current, or if there's jellyfish that are going to sting you on the way, or... It's just, it's a dialogue. And for me,
you understand. You have such a relationship with the sea, I suppose you understand.
Or just trying
it.
To pay attention, or just trying to bring my awareness into it, which to me is the opposite of, I don't care what's happening, I'm just doing it anyway. Hasn't really ever worked for me, not in free diving.
So you need to be fluid.
Yes, exactly. Fluid and soft is always my word for it.
Yes.
So that's how I prepare. And... So I'm on the buoy. I'll take out my snorkel. I take my breath. I take my big breath, fill up, pop out the snorkel. I let it fall away. My coach will grab it for me so it doesn't go to the bottom. And then I start my dive. I turn upside down and start my dive. And off I go.
And you've got to 60 meters.
No, I've got to 59. 559 is my breath hold.
This is interesting, isn't it?
No, it's not. It's so frustrating.
I wonder what's in that for you. Do you know the 59s?
No. Well, last year the plan was to break 60 and to keep going. But I guess now it's going to be postponed until 2022.
But is that a strange coincidence? 559 and 59
there's
meters?
There's always a thing around a zero number. Because it's a big marker.
Okay.
So usually if I'm going for a PB, I'll try to aim for 61. You can go up in jumps of 5 meters down to 2. You can go to 0.5 if you want. It's certainly not recommended to do more than 5 meters. So when I get back up to 59 comfortably, I won't aim for 60, I'll aim for 61. Zero numbers are always just a bit intimidating.
Isn't it interesting that your response to that was kind of like, ugh. Haven't got there yet. Whereas, like what you have achieved so far, 8 times national record holder. It is the stuff of dreams,
it is,
probably for the majority of people who are doing what you're doing.
I did make a decision in 2017 that I wasn't going to train full time. Training full time would mean living out in Egypt, for example, or somewhere else. And I do want more of a balance. It is a different, very, very, very different way of living. And I do love Ireland, and I also love the Irish Sea. Excuse me. So in that decision, there is a curbing of where I might get to.
Yeah.
Of course, if I was training, doing a proper full training cycle twice a year, building up to the peak cycle when you hit your PBs, your personal bests, and then going into competition, of course, I'd probably... Sure, look, let's say I'd be in the 80s at this stage. Who knows? I definitely have progressed a lot further. So in that choice of wanting to spend time in Ireland, and I did, I made that decision consciously, and it was reaffirmed for me in 2019. The absolute dream would be half the year in Ireland. I love sea swimming here. Mm. I love the rawness of the water here. I get homesick for that. And obviously family and friends are here. So spending half the time here talking about freediving, teaching about it or whatever, teaching about breath. I'm really passionate about that. So that's half the year. And then the other half is off diving.
Yeah. Yeah.
Training, competing.
Yes. And I sense from you, from what you've told me so far, is that you, nothing ever stays the same for you.
No.
You like to mix it up. And you've done a lot so far in your career, in your life.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello? Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
There was a turning point for you when you were about a teenager when you said, just, I'm going to park the swimming for the moment, and you embraced drama, performance, and you went a totally different direction.
Yeah, yeah. I think I started drama maybe 4 or 5 years old. I can't remember. I've done it forever. And at the same time had been swimming. And then about 13, 14, I think it was the summer, between 13 and 14, when the coaches I was swimming with wanted me to start those early morning sessions before school a couple of times a week. I already was doing, I think, maybe 3 training sessions a week. I also played the piano. I also studied musicianship. I went to speech and drama. I say it now. I'm just so grateful to mum and dad. It was not a big deal if we wanted to do it.
Yeah.
If we showed a commitment, they made it happen. Mm. How lucky is that? Oh my gosh.
Mm.
Note to self, thank mum and dad. It's incredible just even to say it out loud. So when that change kind of started happening, 13, 14, and it was going to look like, okay, the next phase was me to start the sessions before school. And I just thought, no.
Yeah.
No. wasn't for me. Perfectly happy with that decision. I'd no real grow to go on and do competitive swimming. I'd kind of dabbled in it. Obviously, 13, 14 is kind of prime puberty years.
Sure.
I was bigger than a lot of the guys my age. I'm starting to become aware of that. So, yeah, it just kind of switched over to drama. Still went to the Saturday night swims, I think up until I was 18.
Yeah.
There was no other activity that we all did together. I think I was 17, 18 when I stopped Saturday night swims with the lads. Seriously. So, yeah, that was the turning point, I think, more towards drama and singing, whatever it was.
Yeah, and you've done so much. I mean, you've worked with the Lambert Puppet Theatre. You've been a puppeteer, singing, as you said, acting, the works. And then you went through a difficult period in your 20s.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is not something that you often speak about in the context of a podcast, but you have nonetheless spoken about as well that you did struggle with your mental health.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the change I'm making now is it wasn't mental health, it was mental illness.
Yeah.
To 2005, I finished my BA, and the summer after that, things went to shit. I didn't know what was happening. I had gotten into an MA, a master's program in London. So I remember I was working quite a lot to earn money for it. So I was working during the day, and I was also doing night shifts. So obviously tiredness was a huge factor. Something else happened. Something else shifted. And the image I have of it in my head at the moment is kind of a strange one, but I think of it like a baseball field. Not that I play baseball, but I kept on moving further and further away from home base.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you try and make a decision and you might be stressed or you might be in the middle of things and it isn't that clear, but you always feel like once you put your foot onto home base, you can sense what's the right decision for you.
Mm.
I felt like I was so far from home base. I just began to lose a sense of who I was, lots and lots of tears for reasons that I couldn't quite understand. So I headed off to London then that October. The Masters itself was really, really tough. There was some breaking down to build up. It was a Masters in movement, kind of in a theatre setting.
Mm.
I was away from my family and my boyfriend at the time. And that year was really, really tough, and a lot of physical symptoms started to come in. I remember I have quite wild hair. I have a mane, thick hair, and lots of it, and my hair started falling out.
Okay.
So I remember coming home maybe for Easter or whatever it would have been, and I went to the GP, and they were ready to put me on antidepressants. And I said, oh God, no, nothing like that. And then when I finished, I moved home pretty much as soon as I could. So I think I finished my thesis at home, and things were pretty bad there then. So my world had become quite small. So when I talk about my world, I mean like where I was prepared to go. I remember we got the bus into town one night. So from where I lived in Maynooth into town, and that was just too far. I felt quite panicky and stressed about being so far from home.
Yeah.
So that was, again, a new feeling. And I think I just absorbed it. A really big part of what followed the next couple of years. I didn't fully understand what was happening. That relationship that I was in broke down quite soon after that.
Didn't help.
No, it left me pretty emotionally raw, but yeah. The kind of chicken and egg, which came first. So the following years, kind of for much, certainly from 25 or certain 24 to 29 anyway, it's all a blur.
Mm.
It's all a blur, kind of dates and things kind of intertwine. I was really sick, and, you know, I'm 38 now. I would love to go back 13 years and give her a massive hug. She was fighting so hard, and the fight was to stop people seeing what was really, really happening. Predominantly my parents and my sisters and my brother, I wanted to protect them from that because I was in absolute and utter turmoil. So I was fighting so hard to just not let people see
that you were struggling.
Yeah, I'm really, really struggling at the time.
What was it, pride?
You know, I think it's easy to identify it now as pride, but denial maybe. And again, this idea of, and maybe it was tainted by, you know, but sure, what have you got to be upset about? You know, as far as I was concerned, I'd been offered so many opportunities so far in my life. I'd gone to London to study exactly what I wanted, and my parents supported that. You know, that in itself is incredible.
Yeah.
You know, I'm close with my family, and I had friends and so on. So there is a thing of, why do I feel like this? There was such a discrepancy with what my life looked like on the outside and how I felt inside. Yeah. So I found it really hard to match the two of those. I had a really terrific conversation on Saturday with Louise Carroll. I think she's a bass player for the Blizzards and a clinical psychologist.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, she's amazing.
So I only met her on Saturday, and we were doing an event, Mind Your Low, for Jason Byrne.
Yeah,
it was a really great event to be involved in. So I did speak a bit about my own experience in that, but afterwards I sat in and watched Louise. And when she was talking, I was like a nodding dog. I think I probably used so much energy just nodding in agreement with her. And so afterwards, I kind of nabbed her and we ended up having quite a chat. So, you know, her take is quite different. Obviously, she's a professional background. So she spoke about, and this is something I feel quite passionately about, this idea of it's okay to not be okay, if that's the phrase or hashtag or whatever.
Yeah.
And whilst that's great in theory, I think there's a really big gap about, okay, so if you're not okay, okay, so society has said it's okay not to be okay, now what do I do?
Yeah.
So, okay, well, I talk to someone. What if that person doesn't know what to do with all this amount of darkness? Or what if they say the wrong thing? And I know that happened to me a couple of times. Maybe I shared with the wrong people. Maybe they weren't able for what I was going through. Maybe it was kicking off something for them that they weren't, who knows?
Yeah.
So something that I feel quite passionately about is, you know, saying, yes, of course it's okay not to be okay. And if you are struggling, talk to someone, but let that person be a professional.
Yes.
Let that person be someone trained to deal with these issues. Someone that, you know, at the end of the day, okay, they're not going to go forget about you and wash their hands by any means, but they have trained to be somewhat detached. You know,
it's a really good point. We had a discussion on the podcast a few weeks ago with a therapist and a counsellor, and we were speaking about this very thing. And I think, you know, again, for people listening, they've either been the person opening up to somebody who hasn't been able for it or said the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Or whatever. Or on the other hand, you've had somebody open up to you and you feel completely unequipped.
Exactly.
And know what to say. And you might put your foot in it without realizing.
But that's it. And I know for me at the time, and I know I can imagine, I have an inkling, it was incredibly difficult for my family. They didn't know what to do. And that doesn't mean that they were ignorant by any means. But for me, nothing was right.
Yeah.
So I was seeing their concern. So I was seeing myself reflected back to me in their concern. I just was rejecting all of it. So I was so angry. And in fact, I used to call it rage, but it's not rage, small or, it's the rage, capital T, capital O. It would just spill out of me, whether it was rooted in not feeling understood or validated or whatever. But, you know, I've five other members of my family. There's six of us in total. They don't deserve any of that. They are trying. They are learning just as much as I am at the time. I'm just using them as an example.
Yeah, I getcha.
But no one of them could have healed or fixed me. That's not how this works.
And so what did work for you?
What did work? I did spend 2-3 month periods, I think, in hospital in St. Pat's.
Yeah.
That was really difficult. Coming out was really, really difficult. There's an element of being institutionalized after it. I did find that probably more harrowing. I did see a psychiatrist for quite a while. and there was quite a lot of medication and some diagnoses. And again, that is all quite a big blur. Finding right medication can be quite a traumatic experience. Coming up to my 29th birthday, all the nines,
yeah.
So things leading to a zero. Leading up to my 30th birthday, I had decided I wanted to try and come off all medication. So I did this, and obviously this is the big one, with my doctor.
Supervision, yeah.
Yeah, so we did that. So shortly after that, he recommended I see a wonderful counsellor. Talk about giving someone a gift. He referred me to my counsellor, who I now dip in and out of, kind of for whatever now, eight, nine years I've been seeing her. She's terrific. And I always just think of it like the dentist. So obviously I'll go to the dentist if there's a problem. But I also see the dentist every 6 months to just get my teeth cleaned and a quick checkup. So
that's a great way of putting it, yeah.
Yeah, so to me it's the exact same, and I have such a...
Topped up.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just... And I just think it's somewhere that a space is held for me that it's neutral. I'm not going to upset anyone, and it's just to spill my brain. There's a really, really, really terrific picture that describes counselling or therapy or whatever, and it's someone holding two balls of wool that have all intertwined, and the counsellor's just sitting and has the red one on one side and the yellow, and that's all she's doing. It's just helping separate.
Yes.
There's no magical solutions. It's just giving you questions or giving you a space to figure things out for yourself.
That's right. If it's not too personal to ask, was there a name or a label put on what you were going through at the time?
Yeah, there was two. There are plenty more, but the two I gave are, first it was depression, and then it was bipolar disorder type 2. And after that, I don't pay attention to the names anymore, because I grew quite attached to my label at the time, which is bipolar. It gave me a place to fit in. It gave me a forum online of where to research and who to chat to. And when that was changed, I felt really at sea. What a reference. I felt like my identity had been stripped from me. And my counsellor at the time, I can't remember if my counsellor or my doctor, but they basically said, whichever it was, said a rose by any other name would smell as shit. Learn the symptoms, learn how to manage them, and then know when to ask for help. And that's probably the big one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you've brought up a big one there as well. Labels can be helpful in a lot of situations, but they can also be destructive as well, in that we become so defined by what we've been told, and that we can't see beyond it. But actually, we're so much more than just a label.
100%. And I do understand how it happens. You know, when it does affect your day to day so hugely, it's so all consuming. And there were, you know, for years, oh my gosh, like my family would be looking up things that might help. And, you know, everything, you know, just kind of revolves around. And I remember there was someone suggested a book as a present. And, you know, your birthday's coming up. And I was like, I don't want a present this year that has to do with maybe helping my depression. I want nail varnish, something just really fluffy, you know, because it can be, you know, quite a lot. And when this happened, when my diagnosis changed, it was my early 30s. I think it was about 31, 32. It was a huge, now I suppose I use the word setback. It absolutely threw me. But it really doesn't matter to me anymore. And the same, my counsellor said, diagnoses are there to figure out medication and a treatment plan. You have an idea of what you want to do for medication, which at the moment, you know, is none. And treatment, you're coming here and you're learning mindfulness and CBT. And you're managing it. So we got this.
Fair play to you.
And a fair play to her. She was absolutely super.
I'm not taking it from that, but you're still the person that has to do it.
Yeah, and it's hard work.
And if you were on a cocktail of meds to come off, that was a huge, probably, adjustment period as well. I'm sure
it
was.
Huge. That's the blurriness.
Mm.
definitely.
You've been through a lot. I mean, look, we've still only kind of scratched the surface, but, and I'm saying that in a, I admire you massively in a respect way, in a kudos to you, because you are a phenomenal person. And you look at the highlights and you go, you know, 8-time national record holder. She can hold her breath for this long. She can go this far underwater. You know, you're a keynote speaker. You do all this cool stuff. But it hasn't been an easy road for you, as is often the case with impressive people.
But I think, you know, everyone has a story.
We do.
Guests on your podcast.
We all have our own stuff.
Incredible story.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's a really big part of mine. And there is a big part of me. I'm so glad social media wasn't what it was when I was going through all this. I remember being in hospital and feeling really passionate about changing the world. Mm. I wanted to change how the world, and starting by Ireland, starting with friends and family, how they felt and thought about mental health. And I was ready to take on a crusade. I would have destroyed myself in the process. And I would have put myself in a place of absolute vulnerability when I probably wasn't able
ready.
For it.
Yeah, yeah.
So now it's a good, you know, 10 to 13 years since I was at that kind of heightened stage.
So you feel stronger and in a place now that you can talk about it.
Absolutely. And I'll talk about it kind of in the right setting.
Yeah.
And I think there is a lot to be gained from sharing. I was asked in a podcast early last year, have I always been so confident? And I think I probably snotted the Zoom screen laughing so hard. Because you're kind of going, if you heard inside my head, you would crack up laughing. So obviously I'm aware of that whole history of, you know, building up and moving forward. But what I've learned, and again, it's something I chatted briefly to Louise about on Saturday. What I believe firmly about is the phrase I use is sitting in the shit.
So
there's a huge spectrum of mental health issues, also mental illnesses, and spectrum of wellness. But there's also emotions. And I used to be terrified of negative emotions because I was afraid they were going to tip me off into a depressive episode. I didn't trust my emotions at all. They were so dysregulated. Mm. And it was never just a little bit sad. It was huge. And it was depression really, really quickly.
Yeah.
But what I'm learning and what I have been learning was that actually really valuable things come from feeling disappointed, sad, anxious. You know, these are really valid emotions. And, you know...
And normal.
They're part of the human experience. And if you don't get them, you don't get the other side.
Yes.
Happiness, contentness, sense of achievement and so on. So you do have to learn how to sit with them a little bit more. And that's why this idea of just be positive, you know, encouraging positivity all the time. It's like, no.
Absolutely.
Let me be versatile. Let me show you how I can handle them all. And I have done some really cool things. I have gone to cool places, I've tried cool activities, and all of them will have come from one little place of sitting, maybe in my PJs, with loads of coffee cups around me, or cups of tea and empty packets of crisps, and who knows what's happened.
Yeah, yeah.
All of them will have come from a really low moment.
Yeah.
So something really great can come from sitting in the shit.
Yeah. That's so big, isn't it?
Mm. I try not
Jesus.
To hurry those moments along. Mm. They get to have their time just as much as any other emotion.
Yeah.
And then, right, okay, here's your coat. It's been nice.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to just start clearing up around you now. Off you go.
And that's
one of my dad's one. He goes, right, give it a cup of tea and then show it the door.
Very good.
It's just allowing a little bit of space and then ushering it on its way.
Yeah. I'm flooded with goosebumps now when you're speaking because it's just bringing up a lot of my own stuff as well. And if that's happening for me, it's happening for people listening.
It has happened.
Because we've all had shit times.
We've all had shit. And so
and if we're here, we've come through the shit.
Exactly. And we're all on Instagram or whatever social media platform we're on, and we see these beautifully curated feeds.
Yeah, and that's what they are.
Oh, 100%. We all see it. We all scroll. Oh my gosh, we spend so much time on it. Actually, it's okay to show the man behind the curtain. My favourite film is The Wizard of Oz.
Wizard of Oz, yeah.
All powerful Oz, and just lift the curtain and there's this little man.
Small man.
Yeah, just moving these things, and actually he wants to be somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I think a lot of people that will resonate with. Like, that's me, you know. Sometimes I have the most beautiful photos on my Instagram feed because I'm friends with really beautiful photographers. You know, and there's some amazing people that I have taken pictures of me, and then I walk by.
Yeah, but
the
you're also gorgeous, so it's just also the canvas. It's a combination.
But like,
it's
then like, you walk by the mirror and you see like sour cream splattered all over your face, and you wonder, when did I have spaghetti, you know, in your eyebrow? But your look.
Hey,
know.
Yeah.
Love it. Spaghetti in my eyebrow.
Oh, yeah. God, this conversation has been brilliantly unexpected. And weirdly, it was one of the more mapped out chats that I had done. I told you, we're going to talk about this, then we're going to go here, we're going to go there. None of it happened.
Plan out the window. Best chats are like that, though.
Of course they are. Mm. Always. Absolutely always. You are, and this is one of the things that came to me, is she's the queen of reinvention. Mm. Just when I was listening to you and talking about, you know, so you've done this, you've done that, and you've done the other. You've done so much already in your career, from being, you know, a champion freediver to, you know, excelling in music and acting, performance, puppetry, you know, really interesting work that is extremely creative as well. And I know you're writing a book.
Yeah.
So that's another.
Very, very, very early stage. I'm probably putting on the moxers on it now, but you're.
But very exciting.
Really, really exciting. I was approached by a publishing company late last year, and they asked me, would I write a book for them? So I scrambled and got an agent. I'm pals with Ruth Fitzmaurice, who wrote I Found My Tribe.
And she was
super in terms of just giving me bits of tips, advice. So I got an agent and we had the chats, and the next phase was putting together a proposal. And I did that. Actually, the first draft of the proposal, sorry, I'm giggling to myself here. I wrote on day two of COVID symptoms. So with a temperature and being totally out of it.
Yeah.
And then I hit send, and my agent, who I haven't met because all this is done on Zoom, she probably read it and went, oh, sweet Jesus, what did I take on? And like the idea.
Did you read over it afterwards? Did it make any sense?
No, I can't read over that. I am deleting that file forever. I'd say I probably couldn't even spell my name right on that day. But I just hit send, I was like, God, that's great to get knocked out one day from my bed. Oh, gosh. So obviously we did a little bit more work to do than that. So we put together a proposal, and she's been terrific, and she's really guided me and has a genuine interest in what I have to say.
Yeah, well, I have a major interest in what you have to say. I know this is going to be a fascinating read.
Yeah.
And also, you know, you're only 38.
I'm only 38.
So there's a lot more life to be lived and experiences to be had.
Yeah.
On the list, do you have other stuff you want to do? Because obviously your love and your passion for not just swimming, but diving and competitive diving is there. But you've a lot of other interests as well.
I've loads of other interests. It's funny, and I suppose it's to finish off that story. Like the book has become a real big passion. The company that approached me actually have since passed on my proposal. And I thought that once, I thought I probably wouldn't pursue it. Look, it was nice to do. But writing it, I learned that I actually want to tell a story. And, you know, I never would have considered myself a writer, but I really, really enjoyed the months that followed that fevered day in lying in bed writing. So writing the proposal, putting it together over the next months that followed. So I've just finished it. was really incredible. And I think it was a really good exercise in grounding myself in what I do, what I want to do, and what I know. And I think that's really going to help the next phase of my career, whatever that might be.
And can we answer those questions now?
What did I say again?
What do you want to do? What you know?
So what do I want to do? It turns out I want to share my story. So definitely want to come back to the mental health thing a little bit, or mental illness, and share that a bit more. Maybe now's the time. And, you know, free diving and what it's... I have spoken more about this in podcasts and interviews, etc. But actually kind of maybe showing the rest of the story behind that. And I think if I was to add another question, like what would I like someone to take from that, is to show that, you know, we often... I would have had a perception that people who do these things have this, you know, tremendous courage and that they're almost like a different breed.
Yeah, but superhuman.
Yeah, but I know I've made those decisions, and those decisions aren't made with your hands on your hips staring, you know, off into the horizon with a cape flowing at the back, as well as this image. Actually, those decisions to change and to go after something are usually made at quite a humbling or low or very real moment. They're not... That's where those decisions can be made to, I need to make a change. I need to change shit up. Yeah, so for me, it was, right, there's world championships next year. I'm going to go for it. I was so unfit at the time when I made that decision.
Okay.
I just wanted a project. I wanted to change. I wanted to change how I thought. I wanted to blow apart these self-beliefs, or, you know, this belief system that had kind of made its way into how I conducted my life over quite a short space of time, and limited what I was doing. So, deciding to do a world championship representing your country is quite a big one, but it can be anything. So those changes are always possible at any time, I believe, as opposed to, 32, you know, you're married and you might have a partner and a house, and that's your career, full stop, shinny, that's it now. That can change any time. You can reinvent or go after something just for the crack, just to see what the journey is like, just have a play, a bit of curiosity. And I actually popped up something on Instagram yesterday, you know, what holds us back? And the majority of the responses are myself.
Yeah.
So
I identify with that. I think a lot of us do.
Yeah. Myself.
We get it in our own way, don't we?
100%. Whether it's because of imposter syndrome or our own limiting self-beliefs. But yeah, I think I've learned that I want to write the book that I would have loved to have read at 32. That I needed to read at 32. I didn't have the boxes ticked. I didn't have a partner, I didn't have a house, I didn't have a family, I didn't have a career with a clear trajectory of where it might go. Therefore, I felt like I was doing it all wrong. So I would love to write a book that goes back to 32-year-old Claire and gives her permission to go, no,
look
at all the other things you can do.
I was just about to say, you're nothing wrong.
So
it's okay.
But it's funny how locked into this belief that you can get.
Yeah.
So,
of ticking boxes, as I said.
Exactly.
So if mental illness was a player in your life at one point, how do you feel about it now? And what do you do to keep yourself, as you said, topped up? You still dip in and out of therapy when you need it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I know you swim in the sea on a daily basis. Are these all practices that help you to mind yourself?
100%. And, you know, I make the differentiation between, so there's therapy and then therapeutic things. So I do therapy with my counsellor, a trained professional. But that doesn't mean that getting into the cold water with my salt sisters and having lots of coffee afterwards, that's therapeutic.
Yeah, of course.
So that makes me feel great. That's my routine. And there's lots of other things. And I think I've become a little bit more diligent about routine, a little bit. There's lots of room for improvement on that one, by putting in structure to my wellness, particularly in the last whatever, what, since March 2020. Mm. And that would be breathing practices. That would be mindfulness, meditation, because we need it. I need it. And I'm always so aware of where it can go.
And when you don't do it, you feel that,
yeah,
don't you?
Yeah.
When it slips.
Exactly. Exactly. So I would be relatively diligent about checking in with myself. You know, I think mental health will probably be something that will be in my life forever. It certainly doesn't dictate my day-to-day anymore.
Mm.
It's not... I don't put it as part of my, you know, internal biography, you know, Claire yeah. Walsh, I, XYZ.
Mm.
That it doesn't really come into it anymore.
Are you afraid of it?
I don't think I'm afraid of it. I'm...
Great.
I'm proud of what I've learned from it.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a phrase that a psychologist somewhere along the way mentioned it to me. I'm very sensitive. And before I would have seen that as being wildly negative.
Okay.
You know, God, you're so sensitive. You know, yeah. That really, it's almost like an insult. But she coupled it with another word, which changed it completely. She said, you have an exquisite sensitivity.
Yes.
It's like, I can take that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, exquisite sensitivity makes me pretty creative. It gives me skills within, I don't know, I run a gospel choir. I used to run a gospel choir.
Yeah.
I was able to hear things that needed to be tweaked. You know, it gave me a keenness or a sharpness to maybe things that are less tangible, maybe aware of them. So.
And then you could apply that to.
I can apply that to so many things.
Yeah.
So, you know, you definitely, there's a knife edge. It can be a really bad thing. It can also be a really, really great thing. So I'm far better at harnessing it or shoving it over into the really great camp. So I am who I am because of it.
Exactly, exactly. You're embracing who you are in all your glory, yeah. As you said.
Oh, yeah.
The good
bits. Pseudo cream and spaghetti in my eyebrow and all.
Oh, you have to get that in the book somewhere.
It's going to be like a whole chapter. Or maybe that's the sequel.
Oh, Claire, thank you. This has been a gem of a conversation.
It's been incredible.
Really unexpected in the best kind of way. And I'm really excited for the book. I'm excited for however many chapters in your life that will that will unfold, because you're a really interesting human being.
Thank you so
and a
much.
Fabulous person. And I've admired you from afar, so meeting you in person, it has been such a joy. And I know this conversation will help people. So good on you for using your voice to do something good, you know. It's great.
Thank you so much. This has just been incredible. What a gorgeous way to spend an afternoon.
All right, back at you. Thanks, Emil.
You've been listening to Ready to Be Real Conversations. If you like my podcast, please show your support by leaving a rating or a little comment on Apple, or by clicking follow on Spotify. I'd be so grateful.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
If you're concerned about mental health or looking to get into self-improvement, join me at the Piece by Piece podcast. There, I'm interviewing everyday people and experts alike about how to overcome difficulties around mental health. Speaking of which, I just released an interview with a mental health historian and another with two friends who are healthcare workers.
If these conversations interest you, check us out at Piece by Piece. That's Piece with an A, B-I, and then Piece with an I. Thank you so much.